Hello, time for The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Ramona Koval with you. And today we revisit the myth of Emily Dickinson. She's not exactly the strange, helpless lady poet who dressed in white and never left her room after all. Her biographer, Lyndall Gordon, joins us shortly. But I wanted to read a letter we got after Sarah Dinant told us her career interest in history started with the Angelique series of books. This is from a listener called Tonya. She says, "The Angelique historical series by Sir Jean Gollon. Yes, I am the other person who was turned onto history through this series. Without a doubt, they would also be the most influential books in my reading life until my 40s. And not only that, as a mature age student, I did European history. I made a particular point in an argument about Louis XIV's great financier Colbert. My lecturer thought the point perceptive and asked where my obvious fascination with Colbert came from. I was the only one who did that essay. Blushingly, I told him, and he looked completely gobsmacked. Middle-class women doing mature-age degrees, it seems, were not expected to be interested in early mercantilism. These books are still available. I saw them recently in a bookshop in Melbourne, and it set me smiling for the rest of the day. I have since researched their genesis and found support to my own knowledge that they were exceedingly well-researched. Angelique, Angelique, your adventures also include the unpardonable sin of stimulating minds. Devil woman, you." Well, and speaking of devil women, the story of Emily Dickinson might well be said to contain at least one, possibly one and a half, devil woman. Emily Dickinson, the genius lady poet of Amherst, Massachusetts, unsung in her lifetime, was regarded by at least one man as half angel, half demon, and certainly the editor of some of Dickinson's posthumously published poems, Mabel Loomis Todd, sounds like a devil woman, or at least a devilishly manipulative one. And maybe manipulation was what she shared with Dickinson, who she called her friend, although she never met Emily. Now, not that she wasn't in close proximity to Emily. After all, she spent years having a passionate affair with Emily's brother, Austin, in the very house where Emily lived, a place she rarely strayed from. It's an intriguing story, one that's been told by our next guest, the esteemed biographer of T.S. Eliot, Virginia Woolf, Henry James, and Charlotte Bronte. She's written Lives Like Loaded Guns, Emily Dickinson and Her Family's Feuds. And Lyndal Gordon joins us from ABC's Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome to the book show, Lyndal.
Thank you.
Can we begin by talking about what kind of a place was Amherst in these days, and who were the Dickinsons?
Well, Amherst was a small town of 4,000, and it was in western Massachusetts. That is, it was a provincial town. It was much more puritanical than metropolitan Boston, which was largely Unitarian. There were many revivals in Amherst, Massachusetts, and Emily Dickinson's family was caught up in these revivals. They were spiritually very serious, high-minded people, although they were also had a very good sense of humor, as you see in Dickinson's poems. She and her brother Austin lived in adjoining houses, and this was a very close family until a young faculty wife, Mabel Loomis Todd, as you mentioned, sashayed into town, shall we say.
Yes. Well, look, just before we get into the sashaying, I just wanted to talk a little bit about Emily's father and then her brother. They were sort of upstanding members of the town, weren't they?
They were. You could almost call them the kings of Amherst. Mabel Loomis Todd, in fact, called Austin my king. Their ancestors had been founders of the town, and Emily Dickinson's grandfather, Samuel Dickinson, had founded Amherst College. So they were the elite, if you like. Mr. Dickinson, the father, was called Squire, and after he died, his son Austin was called Squire. They were, as I said, very high-minded, and for Austin to have fallen in his 50s for a young faculty wife was highly improbable.
Let's begin, though, by talking about Emily Dickinson, the poet. Now, these days, how is she seen as a poet?
She has become increasingly famous, one of the great poets of all time, I think. it's fair to say. In her lifetime, she was unknown. Only about 10 poems were published, and none with her authority. So we don't know anything about how she would have wanted her poems to look. They exist in manuscript. They look idiosyncratic because she uses dashes almost to push words apart. Those people who saw her poems, who were men of letters at the time in the mid-19th century, thought she was ignorant, but actually she was highly educated. She was one of the very early women to have a college education. It was deliberate.
Well, I should read an Emily Dickinson poem, I think, now, so people can just remind themselves about what sort of things she wrote. This is one called Hope. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me. That's a lovely poem, isn't it?
Yes.
Do you like that one?
I do like it, though it's not entirely representative of the Dickinson I'm trying to bring forward.
But she did write it, though, Lyndall.
Yes, yes.
You can't deny that. But yeah. But look, let's talk then about who she, what she looked like, and what the sort of the myth around her was. And I want you to read a little bit from your book, from the chapter called The First Family, which really describes her. Could you do that reading for me?
Yes, I'll begin now. Her spaced eyes and large, full mouth were too keen for the passivity admired in women of her time. The well-known daguerreotype taken when she was 16 bears the face of a person who, as her brother put it, saw things directly and just as they were. Her sister called it a startling face. There was a widening divide between people she wished to know and those she didn't. She abhorred sham, social talk instead of truth, piety instead of, quote, the sole superior instance. Her directness would have been disconcerting if she did not, quote, simulate conventionality. This she could do as a girl longing for Valentine's or tinkling out, quote, a sweet little song, Maiden Weep No More. Or playing to the solemnity of pious girls, she appeared indistinguishable from her contemporaries. Yet she grew less inclined to make the effort. Though she disparaged herself as the only kangaroo amid beauty, she had the creature's long sloping neck holding up a sensitive face with the full eyes of a watcher. Another self-image is consciously charming, with eyes like sherry at the bottom of a glass, she said, and hair the colour of a chestnut burr. She sees herself in colour, but adjusts this to contemporary taste, for her hair was red, like her brother's. She had the pale skin and summer freckles that go with red hair. A schoolmate recalled her voice as high and clear. It had, quote, a strangely indefinable quality of surprise, almost an accent of consternation. Austin's voice had a similar interrogative lift. What the schoolmate thought strange was a teasing irony. One of her poems pictures herself as a wren, small, neat, with eyes and head on the alert. The daguerreotype shows the delicate frame of a girl who, from time to time, was removed from school for reasons of health. As she moved through her 20s, when she was fanning her poetic fire, she would have made no concession to the ringlets and doll-like crinolines of the 1850s. Her full, slightly jutting lower lip would have firmed as she grew older. The assurance and humour of her mature writing suggests an air of composure, unlike the vulnerable girl. The vulnerable image encouraged the pathos woven into her popularity. How the public loves a wounded genius. How it loves her all the more if she be unmated, seething with love denied, an all-time poet unrecognised in her lifetime. But the Emily Dickinson who speaks through her letters makes no concession to helplessness. This is not a person so frail, so wrapped up in writing that in time she would sidestep the rupture in her family. Nor is she unmindful of her family standing, a status too secure for ostentation or the ephemeral absurdities of fashion. The one surviving dress confirms her continued simplicity. Her curly hair, cut short in her early 20s, was long again in her late 20s, parted in the centre and drawn back over her ears in smooth bands. The uprightness of her posture suggests New England correctness. This young woman has gentility, more distinguished in its way than aristocratic gentility, because there is nothing above it, nothing between it and the superiority of superior instance. Who amongst us can face her steady, watchful eye? For there's something at the back of that eye that warns us to be very, very careful. How does the propriety fit what's wild in her poetry? The two could only be conjoined in a force field where control, the tight net of the quatrain, and the uncontained, wild nights, are both in play, not in conflict, for control deploys as well as holds down secrets surging to the surface. One flares for a second, a fuse packed with riddling turns of phrase, when she calls Aunt Elizabeth, her father's bossy younger sister, registered at birth as male, quote, the only male relative on the female side.
And that's Linda Gordon reading from her book on Emily Dickinson here on the ABC's Radio National's Book Show with Ramona Koval. Now, we can see that sort of the only male relative on the female side. She had an enormous sense of humour, didn't she?
Exactly, yes. She was extremely witty. She once describes in one of her letters meeting a woman who's old and is asking for directions, and she writes laughingly to a friend, "I directed her to the graveyard to save expense of moving." It's a kind of grim humour, a bit like the Brontes, I think, when they were on their own.
But, this is all, this description from that famous picture of her, how many, there's not too many other pictures, are there?
No, a picture that has been thought for about 10 or 15 years to be her in her 30s, has recently been discredited. She looks rather prim and prissy. I think she was a volcanic character, and she writes about volcanoes and earthquakes and gun in a number of her poems. Of course, that's not the only thing. There is that feathered hope that you read aloud, and there is the domestic side, which is what has been upgraded by her family. They want her to be sort of tame and feminine.
Yes. Well, look, just you as a biographer, you say, who amongst us can face her steady, watchful eye? For there's something at the back of that eye that warns us to be very, very careful. Now, that really says a lot about the relationship you have as a biographer to your subject. Did she intimidate you?
I think she's too inviting to the reader for us to be intimidated. But I think we have to be careful, because this great poetry distills generalizations like perception of an object costs precise the object's loss. And I think that with words pushed apart by dashes, she's giving a kind of theorem of experience distilled from her own experience, but not exactly allowing us to see what is the source of the generalization. So I think that the way to read her, and I don't find it intimidating, is that we should apply the theorem, as it were, to our own lives. And in other words, she's asking of the reader some kind of reciprocal effort to put something of ourselves into those spaces in the poem. And so then I think it works for us. Some poems do tell us a bit about her private self, like when she says, I felt a cleaving in my mind. I think she did suffer from some kind of illness. And,
well, we'll get on to the illness in a moment. Don't worry, we've got lots of time and we'll get there. So we've got this vision, Emily living with her parents and her unmarried younger sister, Lavinia, in the Dickinson homestead. And when her older brother, Austin, marries, they build the house next door. So the families are in daily contact. And he marries her dear friend, Susan, Emily's dear friend, Susan. And there's a sort of feeling that Emily almost has engineered this, and yes. Susan isn't all that keen on getting married.
That's so. Yes, you've put that absolutely accurately. Susan was the youngest of a family of orphans. She had been very attached to an older sister, and this sister, Mary, had died in childbirth when Susan was 20 years old. This was a trauma from which she hardly recovered. She became terrified, I think, of childbirth. I think that's the main reason, perhaps, that she seems not to have had a wish to marry. She looked around pretty desperately for an alternative to marry. She was living with a brother-in-law who didn't much care to have her in the household. And very bravely, I think, she was a highly bookish girl and very intelligent, but she wasn't sent to college. She went to teach mathematics for a year at a girls' school in Baltimore all on her own. She couldn't make a living. She tried after that to be a carer of a baby in New Hampshire, and she would have loved to have been taken in by the family. You feel a kind of longing in her letters. But there really was nothing for it for a young woman with no money in her generation but to marry. And so partly that coerced her, partly perhaps her older brothers, whom she respected greatly. I think she had a sort of breakdown and she went away to her brothers in the West. But they were ordinary men. They would have wanted her to marry. And Austin Dickinson, we must remember, was the most eligible bachelor in town. He was the top of the social tree, and he was, if you look at a picture in the book, incredibly handsome. He looks like Byron, a sort of moody lock on his forehead look, and he's an obvious, I mean, he's been madly in love with her. Later on, he chose to forget that. So,
but, you know, so in a way, I mean, Emily has got her dear, dear friend Susan, very close to each other. Susan is a great reader of Emily's work and a very good critic of Emily's work and encourager of Emily's work.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
So her best friend marries her dear brother. Although
it's ideal. It's
ideal. It's perfect for Emily, yes.
And she does. We have to say, she's not a sort of soft, fluffy, feminine type. I mean, she does know what she needs and she goes out to get it because she does know Susan. She's seen Susan turn to stone in male company. She said, "You're stone upon stone." She's recognizing a certain frigidity in Susan.
So why does she impose that on her brother?
Well, here I have to give opinion because there's no evidence, you know, that I can cite. But I imagine she does say in one of her letters that she fears that her brother will become like her father. In other words, sort of very puritanical, and I think her father would have given up on marital love fairly early, soon after his children were born. I mean, I can't go into all that detail, but I think that Emily was afraid her brother would stiffen up in that way and become just immensely pious, and she wanted him to remain a human being. So she encourages him in a way to play the field, to flirt with Susan's more vulnerable sister, Martha, who fell in love with Austin and really would have probably made him a better wife. But Austin was fixed on Susan, and he was determined to marry her. And the pressures were very great on Susan, and she did adore Emily, and I think Emily adored her.
And you say that in the 19th century, women's relationships had no sense of deviance, so they were very close, but other people have suggested they may have been lovers even.
Yes. One can't prove it one way or another. I think it's a possibility, but I think it's enough to say that they were ardent towards each other.
Yeah. And so Emily's in her room more or less, and we can we'll explain why you think she might have stayed there. I mean, in a moment. But so she's sort of manipulated this friendship with which turns into a marriage for her brother and her best friend. She has a couple of other female friends that in a sense she alienates them. Some rarely write back after a while, and she sends them little poems and she tries to encourage them, but they sort of flee her. Is this because she's a major manipulator herself?
I wouldn't have used that word exactly, though I think control would be appropriate. I think she needed a great deal of control in her life. But I would say that she had a poet's intensity, and that I remember discussing this with Lenny Girdings, the publisher of Virago, my editor, who got it immediately. I mean, she said she was just too, the word Lenny used was intense, and it just was too much, too much for people. And Lenny liked my metaphor about lassoing. It was like friends would move away and then she would lasso them with letters, letters that would compel them to come back, and some would come back and some wouldn't. And Susan was lassoed. And somehow, because Susan
she was tied down permanently, wasn't she, next door with the
brother.
But
I wouldn't say Susan was pathetic, because the two or three letters that survive of Susan's are feisty, humorous.
Look, the reason why you think she stays in her room, I mean, partly it's, because she was a poet and she needed to work, presumably, and she didn't want to marry and she didn't want to do any domestic work and she just wanted to be an artist. But you feel that she has epilepsy, and you argue this both by looking at her medical history, which is sort of oblique, I suppose, and slant in a way, her family history of epilepsy. But you look at some of the potions she was given by the local pharmacist, and that can be treated epilepsy. That's one of the possibilities. But you also sort of diagnose it by poetry. The poem that you mentioned, I felt a cleaving in my mind as if my brain had split. I tried to match it seam by seam, but could not make them fit. The thought behind I strove to join unto the thought before, but sequence ravelled out of sound like balls upon a floor. So you're saying we can read the illness in a slant way, because she always got away from explicitness by telling it slant. That was her word.
Yes, lovely word. Yes.
You're saying that we can look at the poems and get the secret, because it was a big secret and it was a shame, wasn't it, at the time?
Yes. What made me think of epilepsy more than any other form of evidence was really the secrecy of it. She uses the word tell, shall I tell, to tell or not to tell, over and over in poems. That word tell resonates. And she also calls her, what she calls sickness, she also calls it, as though she can't spit it out. Though here and there in her poem she talks about fits, I'll fit for you. I think that epilepsy was an illness that carried a stigma until fairly recently, well, certainly in the 19th century and before, but well into the 20th century as well. Certain American states passed laws against marriage. She went to see Dr. Jackson, an eminent retired physician in Boston, who really saw only difficult cases in his 70s, and one of the areas of his interest and specialization was epilepsy, though there were many others. I have to say that this is a guess. There's no way one can prove such a thing, especially because lips were sealed. She talks about letting things out through buckled lips, as though it's a kind of, her lips themselves are a kind of crater where she well, as you say, she lets the truth out salon through metaphor. There's what I've done is to put this as a possibility. If it were true, it would explain everything. Everything, I mean, except genius. We can't explain genius.
We haven't got time to explain genius.
No. Well, I personally can't explain genius. But it would explain the conditions of her life.
Yes.
That she was respected and cared for in what she always called my father's house, yes, even after his death.
Now, I should say that we're speaking this morning to Linda Gordon about her book on Emily Dickinson's life called Lives Like Loaded Guns, Emily Dickinson and Her Family's Feuds, and you're on The Book Show with me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National. So that is why she was looked after by her sister, her younger sister, and she was up there in her room, and then in the library. And then arrives Mabel as you say, she sashays into town. She's in her 20s. She's married. She's married to an astronomer who gets a job there at the university. And she basically decides, so she's hearing about this famous woman poet, this strange woman poet, and she decides that the Dickinsons are really her target, doesn't she?
Yes. Yes. I think that she, in a way, fell in love with the whole family. She found, I mean, she was much less keen to go to Amherst than her husband, who had been an Amherst graduate. She felt she was a beauty from the capital, from Washington, very dressy and very accomplished. And she had a presentiment, that's the word she uses, that she was going to do something amazing in her life.
She certainly did something amazing to the Dickinsons, didn't she?
She did. Now, the Dickinsons were curiously unsuspecting, because when Mabel, who had no money, by the way, her parents were very nice people who lived in boarding houses. Her father was a poetic man, another astronomer, but he never had the money for an education. She was incredibly beautiful, and she was trained at the Boston Conservatory of Music. She played the piano brilliantly. She sang solos. She could paint flowers to professional standard. She published pieces in currently fashionable magazines in America.
And she was married to a scandalous man, really, who was a sort of a serial womanizer, wasn't she?
Yes.
He didn't mind that she took this interest in Austin, did he? I mean, in fact, he encouraged it.
Yes. I mean, I don't know if one can fully understand the complexity of the situation, but it's clear that he was a philanderer. She knew this before she married him, and I'm not unsympathetic to Mabel Loomis Todd. She wanted, in a very naive way, to purify him, and she did. She found she couldn't, and she wanted, I think, her own fidelity. So she really, and when she saw magnificent—that's her word—magnificent, regal Austin Dickinson, he was very tall and very grand.
And very married.
And very married. She began flirting with the son, and then the father stepped in as the rival. I don't think he can be entirely absolved of blame. That's why, I mean, there's a certain complexity about this. He's also had a marriage that's not been very sexy,
doesn't sound very sexy. But it was very sexy with Mabel, though, wasn't it?
Very.
And it was very, very sexy in the house next door.
Yes.
At his sister's house, basically.
Yes.
And they used the library, didn't they?
And the dining room. That sounds odd, but the dining room was a sitting room in winter because it was warmer than other rooms. So they used both those rooms. And both those rooms would have blocked the poet from the areas of the house she did use. She wasn't only in her bedroom. She did like baking, and she was downstairs in the kitchen. But in the dining room, she had a second writing table at the window. And in the library, the library was her access to a very important area for her, and that was the conservatory.
And Linda, go and tell us how many years this went on in the downstairs rooms.
Well, it went on from the what was initially a romance was consummated at the end of 1883, and the lovers used the homestead with the consent of Lavinia Dickinson, Emily Dickinson's younger sister, until Mabel Loomis Todd acquired some Dickinson land after Emily's death in 1886.
So it's a long time. Years.
It's a couple of years.
And Emily managed never to meet this woman, ever.
Yes. I think that she must
Though she was coming to her house during the almost every afternoon for ages.
I think it must have been intended. You can't not meet somebody who's coming into the... It's a well-to-do house, but it's not an enormous house. I mean, the front door, the hall leads, you know, straight into the heart of the house. And Emily Dickinson would have used the main stairs. And I think she intended not to see Mabel Loomis Todd face to face. In other words, I'm deducing that she didn't share her sister's assent to the lovers using the house.
Because she was still on Susan's side, of course, her friend's side.
I can't prove it absolutely, but I tried to unpick the riddles in her letters to Mabel Loomis Todd. They're really no more than notes, but they are very riddling. And what gave me the clue was the sarcastic tone. When she wrote to people she loved, you can hear the ardour in her voice and the affection, as the case may be. But in the notes to Mabel, you can hear something more sharp-tongued.
And of course, Mabel claims her as a friend, but she never meets her. And in fact, the first time she sees Emily Dickinson is as she lay in her coffin, as Emily's in her coffin. So she was a kind of stalker of the Dickinsons, but she turns into an editor of Emily's work. In fact, the first person to edit Emily's work into a book after she dies. How did she get hold of the letters? How did she get hold of the poems?
Well, the obvious person to edit Emily Dickinson would have been Susan, who had received more poems than any of other of Emily Dickinson's correspondents. And Susan was somebody Emily Dickinson recognised, understood her, and shared the sense of what they called infinity. Again, every situation's quite complex. Susan did try. She sent out one or two of Emily Dickinson's poems and they were rejected. Now, if you're not a professional, rejection's very painful. And it's painful even if you are professional. And I think that Susan was daunted. Mabel was the kind of professional who didn't let anything stop her. So when nothing happened over the first 9 months, she turned to Lavinia Dickinson, the younger sister who had inherited everything Emily had. And I think that what she did was borrow a typewriter. It was a very new object in the late 1880s. And she typed up two or three poems to tempt Lavinia. Lavinia, once she saw Emily Dickinson's poems, once she discovered them after her sister's death, you know, a whole oeuvre of poetry, she saw the genius. In fact, both these women who survive Emily Dickinson, they're two of three people in Emily Dickinson's lifetime who recognise genius.
And they hate each other, don't they?
Well, not Lavinia and Mabel at first. Lavinia has been helpful to Mabel. She's promoted the lovers wish to meet.
But Susan and Mabel, they both saw the genius in the poems and they hated each other.
Hate is the word. I mean, that hate continued for three generations passed on.
Because there were big arguments and legal arguments about who owned what and who had the rights to Emily and who could create the image of Emily. In fact, the myth comes really out of the people who owned the poems after she died.
Yes, you're right. And you see, the poems were divided. There was a treasure, a cache of poems in the Evergreen, Susan and Austin's home next door. There was a large cache of poems in Mabel's house eventually, and there was a cache of poems owned by Lavinia. So there are three batches, and for the next 100 years, the hate goes on and the battles go on over who owns Emily Dickinson and, as you put it, who has the right to say who she was. And that's how the legends rise that encase the poet right up to the present day, I may say.
And can you tell me, just in the last minute or so, what of the biographer? I mean, how did you get access to all the sides of Emily Dickinson? I mean, you've done a marvelous, tremendous task here.
Well, I love doing it. I love archival work, and there was no special privilege. I mean, it's open to anybody to see the Todd papers, vast, vast quantities, because Mabel Todd kept a diary every day, and she wrote journals, and she wrote unfinished memoirs. I mean, there's just masses, and her daughter Millicent wrote masses. It's all at Yale, and you just have to write a letter and ask if you can come and see it. And there's no prohibition anywhere. It's just a matter of turning over pages.
But all the different pages and all the different versions.
Yes.
And so many of them not quite getting to her herself.
Yes. Well, that, I mean, Emily Dickinson said, "Abyss has no biographer." That resonated for me. I mean, that actually is daunting. I feel at times as a biographer, how dare one intrude on people's private lives? And that's another story. But I do feel that the time has come to risk the abyss. I am taking risks in this book. But so far, happily, in England, where I live, it was published last month. And it's had massively good ascent. And, you know, I feel that it is the time to risk the abyss, and that people are ready to hear it.
Do you feel as if you had to take sides in the fight? In
I
your head?
I tried very hard not to. Now, in an earlier draft, Lenny Goodings at Virago said to me she thought I hadn't been fair enough to Mabel Loomis Todd. And I did see her point. I did adjust accordingly, because Mabel Loomis Todd did do an amazing job with the manuscripts. The handwriting is very difficult. The punctuation is difficult. There's masses of them. They're undated. And she spent literally years deciphering these manuscripts. So though she was, and it's easy to smile over her as a flamboyant character, or it's easy in my case to have called her Lady Macbeth of Amherst, because she really did want Susan to die. But on the same time, I think Lenny Goodings was right to say there's something to be admired in Mabel Loomis Todd. So I tried very hard to stay out of the camps.
Well, you know, it's a tremendous story told very well. Lyndall Gordon, thank you so much for speaking to me today.
It's a pleasure.
And the book is called Lives Like Loaded Guns, Emily Dickinson and Her Family's Feuds, and it's published by Virago.